My name is Sanjeev Gupta, and this is Socialism in the Time of Corona. In this podcast, I'm talking with people with deep experience in socialist and left politics, especially in the US. Our overarching question is, during this pandemic, how might we not only defend whatever gains we've made to this point, but actually advance them? Phase 2, Step 2. That's where we are here in Massachusetts with our economic reopening. Let's begin by recognizing the unusualness of this deliberate contracting and expanding of economic activity, especially in the US, where the very idea of economic planning is sacrilege. Of course, this being the US in the Trump era, there isn't one plan, but more than 50 separate ones, ranging from the relatively competent to the startlingly stupid. Nevertheless, it is worth noting the general acceptance of explicit economic planning, which raises the possibility of doing it for other emergencies like climate change, for example. That we are getting through the pandemic at all is due in large part to food and healthcare workers, those keeping us alive. For this episode, I talked with Claire Hammonds of the University of Massachusetts about these workers' experiences in Western Massachusetts. Hammonds is professor of practice at the UMass Amherst Labor Center, where she conducts applied research and the labor education program. Hammonds has worked with a wide variety of labor unions and worker organizations in the Pioneer Valley and around the state, with a particular focus on improving the conditions of low-wage workers. Hammonds is also the Labor Center's graduate program director and co-editor of the new book, Labor in the Time of Trump. Our conversation was based on a survey by Hammonds and Jasmine Kerrisi, also of the Labor Center, titled, We Are Not Heroes Because It Is Not a Choice, a survey of essential workers' safety and security during COVID-19. The survey was conducted in April in Western Massachusetts during the early stages of the economic lockdown here. Hammonds and colleagues have since updated it with a survey of essential workers across the state, and you can see the links in the show notes. The survey's findings are especially relevant as the state begins to ease its restrictions on economic activity generally, thus exposing more workers to the risks documented in the surveys. In particular, the surveys reveal important differences among these workers in their experiences along the dimensions of occupation, income, and other factors. I began by asking Claire to describe the methods and motivation of the survey.
Right. So basically what we had done in this project is we did an online survey that we recruited participants through a Facebook ad, and we were looking to specifically identify people who were at work, as I said, in that week between April 17th and April 24th, right? So these are people who are not working at home, but are actually going into their job. And we talked to about 1,600 people. And, you know, I think overall, I think the biggest finding is about this, this lack of safety. We also identified several key dimensions on which we were talking about how this played out. And we were really thinking about what are the things that the CDC and other health bodies are saying are the most important things to keep people safe, right? And these include things like social distancing, having training about how to protect yourself from COVID-19 transmission, having access to masks, the ability to have hand sanitizer, as well as regular hand washing. And so we really wanted to ask people about how these things looked at their job. And we found some really big differences, particularly between the type of work that people were doing. Overall, grocery workers and other retail workers felt much less safe at work than healthcare workers. And in some ways, this felt really surprising at first, right? Because the healthcare workers are people who are going into jobs where they're often like actually dealing with sick patients. So the risk is quite known to them. But it is also the case that those are folks who are more likely to have access to protective gear. And, you know, certainly a lot of the stories that we've heard over the last 3 months are about those shortages. But still, you know, they have them at a much higher rate. They also, you know, have more experience dealing with illnesses and transmitted diseases. And for grocery workers, this is sort of a whole new space. And beyond that, they're also dealing with the public in a really different way. They're dealing with people who are coming into the store, who may or may not be following guidelines around safety and having to sort of interact with those folks as well.
So the difference between grocery and healthcare workers, did that map onto, you know, you also break it down by the wage difference, like generally things were better for people, you know, making, I think you your cutoff was $20 for low wage and was it $40 for the upper, what you defined as the,
I mean, across all industries, low-wage workers, so talking about people who are making less than $20 an hour, were about 2 to 3 times more likely than high-wage workers, that is those making more than $40 an hour, to lack access to basic safety measures. As I said, things like masks, hand sanitizers, regular hand washing. And a lot of these low-wage workers were clustered in grocery and other kinds of retail settings that have remained open. So thinking about stores like, you know, like a Walmart or a Home Depot or a Lowe's, those kinds of places.
Yeah. I mean, I was shocked even at that you found a difference in the training, like by, you know, low wage and at the higher wage, like there was even like much less training and safety for the low wage workers, let alone access to equipment. Was that a surprise to you, or does it make sense?
Well, I think the training, again, you know, some of this maps onto what happens in healthcare, which is that in healthcare there are, you know, there is a large cluster of very low wage workers. So we're talking about, you know, certified nursing assistants, personal care attendants, who will be sort of at the, you know, $15 to $20 an hour range. But then that's also, you know, in healthcare, you also have some of the highest wage earners. So we could be talking about doctors or highly skilled nurses who are in that 40 plus hour, more than $40 an hour category. And in grocery, you don't have really any of that high wage sector. You might have some small number of managers that might have appeared, but it was almost entirely low wage workers. And, you know, as you'd sort of expect that, I think in healthcare, the training around safety and COVID-19 transmission would be better, in part because they're actually knowingly dealing with infected patients, or some of them are, but also just the sort of professional standards around how interactions happen in a healthcare setting, which are set, you know, at a state level and also by a number of different professional agencies that represent healthcare workers. And in grocery and other kind of retail settings, you don't have any of that. So you know, it's in some ways surprising, but also I think it does map onto this, some of these issues about what's happening in healthcare.
Did you find differences by union membership? And you tried to get at that in the survey, right?
Yes. So I say yes, but the answer is no. so we did try to get it at it in the survey. We asked a question about whether or not people were union members. And about 20% of our respondents said they were. And this, you know, I think considering the state as a whole, I think that's about right. We know that in Massachusetts, it's about 7% of private sector workers are union members and about 51% of public sector workers are union members. We had a mix in the survey of both public and private. So 20% seems sort of reasonable that you might expect if you sort of have, you're splitting the difference there. But I'd say overall, you know, there really were not significant differences in the safety experiences of union members and non-union members. And, you know, thinking a little bit about why this might be the case, I guess, again, I would point to some of these distinctions between what happens in healthcare and perhaps in other kinds of settings. You know, healthcare, particularly because a large number of our respondents are nurses and heavily unionized, they're also state regulated, right? So even the nurses who are not working in unionized settings, they are governed by a certain set of conditions that come from professional organizations like the American Nurses Association, as well as other state agencies. And I think what might be happening, you know, in places like grocery, where you don't really see a union effect, is that there are some standards that sort of get adopted by the entire industry at large, right? So, you know, where you might see a particular grocery store take up hazard pay, right? If Stop and Shop is negotiating a $2 an hour wage increase during the COVID pandemic for their workers, that oftentimes other employers will then take that up. So sort of a, you know, setting the pattern across it.
I see. Okay.
And, you know, I think that might be what we're seeing here in terms of why we don't really see these differences.
Okay. So even if you're a non-unionized, grocery store, you hear that Stop and Shop has done it, and then you might do it. Well, first, you know, we can't rule out that people just want to do it for the right reasons, but you may also want to do it to remain competitive at a time when people may not be wanting to do these jobs, maybe. Like you said, just there's a sort of industry standard which levels things out, even between unionized and non-unionized places.
Yeah, I think that is one sort of reasonable explanation about what's going on there and why we're not seeing, marked differences in safety experiences.
And did you guys find that in this larger survey in Massachusetts as well?
We did, yeah. There wasn't really a union difference in any of the categories we looked at, and we were looking at the same categories in terms of ability to have masks, social distancing, PPE, other kinds of training. And this was a survey that we did looked at workers across the entire state of Massachusetts, not just the Western Mass region. And we did it for the following week, so the week of April 24th to the week of May 1st.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Thanks for mentioning that. You and I talked about that before I pressed the record button and I forgot to. Okay. So, yeah, the one that we are talking about mostly is the Western Mass, and then you and your team, and then also this Center for Equal Employment Opportunity at UMass. You guys did a survey extending that to Massachusetts as a whole. One of the, and I know you guys didn't break this down by county, and I've been just, you know, following the infection numbers by county, and it just, you know, Hampshire stands out as just being so much lower than not just like in Western Mass, but really Massachusetts as a whole. Are you able to speculate about whether that spills over into your data at all? Like, you know, a Stop and Shop worker in Hampshire County versus someone in, you know, Hampden County?
Right. So we, you know, the workers we were looking at, as I said, were in those four Western Mass counties of Hampshire, Hampden, Franklin, and Berkshire.
Yeah.
And we didn't break it down looking at these differences in county, but as you've pointed out, Hampden County is one of the hardest hit in the state, actually. They've had about, I think, just about 6,100 deaths there. And, you know, interestingly, the other region in Western Mass is Franklin County. That's also been hard hit, at the same extent as Hampden County. But I just highlight that because in some ways, Franklin County and Hampden County are quite different in terms of their demographics, their population, their employment in general. Franklin County being much more rural and more white. But that said, this question of how that might impact people's experiences at work being in a county where the death rate is quite high, or at least, and also the infection rate is quite high. I would say that probably does have quite a big impact. One of the things that, that people talked about as they discussed, these issues of safety. And I would say we actually got quite a bit from people's qualitative responses. The survey itself asked about 25 questions that were sort of multiple choice kind of questions. But at the end, we had these two open-ended questions when we asked people sort of like, what do you want people to know about what's going on at your job? And what would you want to change? And we really got a lot of responses from people. And I would say just reflecting on those responses, one of the things that was clear is that, you know, the widespread presence of the virus causes, you know, extreme anxiety. I think the uncertainty about exposure feels awfully overwhelming. Mm. I'm just going to read you one or two quotes from people we heard from, but, just a grocery store worker who's, you know, earning $15 an hour sort of explains that, you know, it's been extremely stressful and I have had multiple panic attacks that I don't normally have. The only option to improve is to stop working, but I need to work to live. Another person says, I've started having extreme panic attacks about being at work at the onset of COVID-19. We didn't have a lot of information and I couldn't stop myself from worrying. I have four autoimmune diseases and scarring in my lungs from multiple bouts of pneumonia in my 20s. My company wants a doctor's note to be out. My doctor won't see me unless I'm sick. Hospitals are not safe right now. I'm terrified. My mental health has declined. I had to restart my medication for depression and anxiety, and my OCD symptoms are exacerbated. I'm finding it hard to function. And I think, you know, just what's sort of captured in that is the real sort of pain of this uncertainty and sort of not knowing always about what your exposure is. And I would say to the extent that you're in a space where you know that there is more in the county rather, where you know that there's a higher rate of infection, that I imagine that would also translate into to greater stress and fear.
Yeah, that sounds like a very direct potential link. Yeah, gosh, someone like that really should be able to not work in that particular job during the pandemic, right? I mean, that's
right.
Yeah, it just seems really common sense. So, you know, now sort of trying to, you know, you know, I know you all at the Labor Center are constantly linking, you know, your studies to then what people can actually do in their workplaces. So for those of us interested in helping, people sort of doing this kind of work, what might be some reasonable things for us to do? So first of all, as individuals, of course, just not do the kinds of things, some of which you talk about in the survey, as just like behaviors as individuals that subject essential workers to additional stress and possibly infection. But then organizationally, for example, should we be like, maybe going into stores only to buy absolutely what we need? Should we maybe even demand like from stores that they only allow or they only stock, things that are essential? Could that be a way to reduce the risk to these workers?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And a lot of workers we heard from were sort of saying this, especially ones who had high levels of interaction with the public and customers, and feeling like, people are stuck at home because they're not able to go to work and there are stay-at-home orders in place. And so the few places that are open become actually sort of gathering places. We had a worker at a convenience store talking about how some people come in sort of several times a day because they're bored, and they sort of loiter around and sort of like hang out there, talking about people, repeatedly coming in to buy coffee and feeling like, why are they coming in to buy coffee again? Please stay home. And other, workers were talking about some of the people coming in to buy non-essential items, and how frustrating that felt because it made the stores more crowded, and it increased their risk of exposure. And, in Massachusetts, some of our stores, like, for example, a Walmart or a Target, stores that have a grocery section, but then also sell all kinds of other goods that would probably not be classified as essential. People are still able to shop those other goods. And that's not true in other states. In some states, including like Vermont, where stores like Walmart were open, people were not allowed to shop all of the other sections of the store.
Oh, really?
And I think So for workers that, I think that would have alleviated some of the stress, which is just the stress of having to deal with more people when you don't know who they are or what their safety practices have been, and also just it making the job harder.
So in the case of Vermont, was that a state thing or was it Walmart in that state deciding that that's what it would do?
Actually, I'm not quite sure about that. Okay. This actually came up in a response from a district coordinator from a Walmart who had described his experience actually traveling to different Walmarts in the region where he works with several of the stores, and was describing how he felt like it was much worse in Massachusetts because people were able to shop, lots of other sort of non-essential items.
Okay. So this could be something to, first of all, simply document, and then, maybe a way to put pressure on the business end of it as a way of, helping reduce the risk to the people working in those businesses. The case that sticks out to me, the recent when Amazon settled with workers in France, after a 2-week strike, if I'm remembering right, I think they were able to get Amazon to agree to only handle essential items for the duration of the pandemic. In some ways you sort of think, okay, well, sure, as individuals, I can just put off, pushing the button on that, you know, whatever X thing that I don't really need right now. And at least my first couple of weeks, like when all this happened, Amazon seemed to be pretty good about saying, well, we are prioritizing the shipment of only essential things. But now I don't see that. And, you know, so certainly we should ask individuals to do that. But it does seem like if either, you know, like maybe the state of Vermont, or if the company says, okay, look, we're just not doing it. That seems to be the most straightforward way of protecting people. I guess you'd have to figure out what, you know, you'd have to argue with people about exactly what's essential. You know, there could be some subjectivity there. But yeah, I mean, so maybe that's where we should also lean on just, you know, the companies themselves.
Yeah, I think, you know, that is a question. And this, what you were describing about the deliveries, we have this quote from a delivery driver for Amazon who was talking about how, you know, every day feels like Christmas and that they're delivering lots of non-important things, you know, and just the level of work in terms of their deliveries, right? So you might expect that you have like 1 week during the year that's insane. But now it's sort of transformed into this like crazy increased workload that's happening all of the time. And the increased amount of work is also sort of meeting this point in which other employees are leaving because of the pandemic, right? Either because they don't feel safe and they're able to not work, or because they've actually become sick. Mm. You know, and I think what you pose is an interesting question, and it also sort of meets this moment, I think, in the trajectory in which things are actually opening up, right? We've entered, at least in Massachusetts, what is being termed the phase one of reopening.
Yeah.
Yesterday, June 1st, marked the second phase of the reopening. And I think we're sort of, you know, it'll be interesting to see how that gets balanced as the push is to actually open up more things, not to try to find ways to close things down to protect workers.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. I actually had that as the first question I'd sent to you, and you know, sort of your survey was done, you know, towards the beginning of this period, and I was going to ask you what you know you would want to see sort of carried forward into are organizing or, you know, decision making as we enter this quote unquote reopening. And as you said, it's not clear that we'd be drawing the right lessons.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things, you know, in terms of supporting essential workers and, you know, what this category of essential means as more and more people are sort of coming under this umbrella, or like if whether it just disappears if everything's open. You know, I'd say that what we've learned though about being at work when this virus is still very present and, you know, still creating both widespread safety issues as well as uncertainty, you know, I think having safety requirements in the workplace that are clear and enforceable needs to be a first priority. That there should not be a single worker who is not provided with a mask, hand sanitizer, with the ability to wash their hands. And, you know, on the other side of that, I think there needs to be some sort of better enforcement in place. The Boston Globe reported in mid-May that there have been about 13,600 safety complaints related to OSHA that have been filed. And about half of them were closed, and exactly zero of them resulted in any sort of citation or penalty. Right. So the enforcement is not happening from the level of OSHA. I would say that in Massachusetts, there's now there's a form you can fill out online through the Attorney General's office if you're having concerns about health and safety issues in your workplace. that will allow people to report things that are happening. And I think that this will become a really important piece going forward, that the requirements are clear, but also as enforceable, as I said.
Mm. So is this, and I guess I don't know this about OSHA. So is this because, so, you know, if it's purely a federal thing, then I can understand OSHA not doing anything, you know, right now, as just the way the federal government is. But is there a state, like a Massachusetts component to this as well?
So there's not. And you know, really one of the things I would say about OSHA is that it is a federal agency that has been, you know, systematically undone since the 70s. In 2020, the number of OSHA inspectors we have across the country is 862. And this is the lowest number since 1975. Right. You know, and I would also say that currently the OSHA rules around around COVID have actually been less stringent than they've been in previous outbreaks, including with the 2009 H1N1 flu pandemic. So right now, the requirements around OSHA only require that employers consult the Center for Disease Control guidance rather than actually requiring them to follow it.
Mm.
And obviously this standard around consult is quite a bit of, it's a lower bar. And I think, you know, one of the things that's happened as well is that because OSHA itself has been so understaffed and underfunded, the directives at the federal level have been to really only be investigating complaints at very high exposure jobs. So where there's sort of a known exposure. So this is talking about people who are actually working in hospitals, emergency medical centers, or emergency response facilities. In other industries, complaints just generally trigger a letter to the employer that details what the complaint is and informs them. It actually says in the letter that it will not normally result in an on-site inspection, which seems like perhaps not the strongest enforcement language you could use. You know, but, and I think that one of the things to think about in that is then is really, so what is the role for workers and workers' organizations in trying to create their own safety processes and enforcement mechanisms within the workplace. And unions are obviously one mechanism for doing this, but there also can be other forms, other ways of getting workers a seat at the table so that they have a voice in both setting up what safety plans should look like in their workplace. Because oftentimes it's, you know, or always it's the workers themselves who are sort of on the job and on the floor who know how it is that they can protect themselves at work. And also just making sure that having that worker voice as part of the discussion, you know, can ensure that those priorities of worker safety are upheld.
Yeah, gosh. So there's, you know, there's so much I want to ask you about this, but let me try to restrict myself to. So I know one thing that we wanted to make sure to talk about was what you see as the relevance of your findings and then perhaps, you know, the broader survey in Massachusetts as well to the you know, the anti-police and, well, you know, the sort of unrest or, you know, rebellion we're seeing right now. And I know that reflecting the demographics of Western Massachusetts, most of your survey respondents were white, but you did have about 10% of them were non-white. And yeah, if you wanted to say anything about the findings in that context.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the pandemic as a whole has really, you know, unearthed and pulled apart a lot of these existing racist and unjust cracks in our society. And this has, you know, this played out with what we saw among essential workers working during that week and those who responded to our survey. And I think we're seeing that that system play out as well with the widespread protests against white supremacy and policing. You know, we had, as you said, about 10% of the workers who responded to our survey were workers of color, Latino and Black respondents. And our, you know, our population of Latino workers, you know, they sort of disproportionately were holding low wage jobs. About 70% of them were working in jobs, were earning under $20 an hour. And this compares to 45% of the white workers who responded. And then, you know, across all other measures, you know, access to health insurance and paid sick days, you know, they were less likely to have that. They were more likely to be facing issues of food insecurity. We had a number of questions in our survey that were related to issues of security at home, asking people whether or not they had had enough to eat in the last week, asking them whether or not they had experienced insecurity around childcare and also insecurity around housing. And in all of those dimensions, our respondents of color were more likely to have experienced those issues as well. And, you know, as we, you know, the data is showing now that it is Blacks and Latinos who have also been disproportionately affected by the virus itself, right? In terms of, in terms of health outcomes.
That's right. I mean, again, you know, this is, we could basically talk about this all day. It's it's just amazing to watch this unfold now. I have one sort of medium-sized question and then one tiny one about the methodology, which might be interesting to some folks. One of the striking things to me in the survey, you know, in terms of broader class consciousness questions, is that, you know, you found that, you know, a few of your respondents were resentful about the, that, you know, the people who could get more, could earn more, or not earn, sorry, because of the unemployment benefits, were getting more income than people who were working in these hazardous jobs. And they actually expressed that in your survey. And I was just wondering what you made of that, if anything, in terms of, you know, how, what, does that say anything about kind of the basis for class solidarity going forward, or, you know,
So I don't know that it's, so I guess one of the things I would just say to just, to explain the way the unemployment has worked is that, for people who have lost their job during this period, the pandemic unemployment provides them with an additional $600 a week on top of their regular unemployment payment. And this is a quite a large sum, right? Just for comparison's sake, the increase to the unemployment insurance that happened with the stimulus plan that was during the Great Recession in 2008, people were provided with an additional $25 a week in unemployment benefits, right? So $600 a week is a significant chunk, and it basically amounts to, you'd roughly need to be earning more than $28.65 an hour, or else you're probably making out better on your unemployment benefits. And, you know, I think for the workers who are going to work at low wage jobs where they feel unsafe and are being paid less than this, it's a real rub. And I think perhaps the solidarity around it may come when we hit July and these benefits evaporate. And those folks will then also be forced to often be taking some of these low-wage, dangerous jobs. You know, I think it also, yeah, so that's my thought on it. I think it's a really powerful sentiment and also just so understandable for people who are going to jobs every single day where they don't feel safe and they worry about bringing home a virus to their family. They worry about how it's impacting their children. It might mean that they're not able to go see their parents. You know, all of those kinds of things. And then to have it packaged with, well, you get a $2 an hour hazard pay increase that perhaps brings your pay, you know, to $20, feels really unfair. And I think, I don't know that it will undermine solidarity. I think everyone can sort of understand that unfairness, even people who might be collecting their unemployment now.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's at the time when the bill was passed, you know, there was that fantastic sort of video clip of Sanders that went around, you know, berating the Republicans for, you know, being like queasy about adding on the $600 that, you know, and then, you know, the villainous sort of Republicans who said that, hey, basically this serves as a deterrent, you know, to people who, from working, because, you know, you can do better by not working. And so it was just interesting to see that reflected, you know, in a different way. I'm not equating the two kinds of, you know, reasons for people to resent the $600. But, you know, I couldn't help thinking that, you know, if we had the social base to instead say, hey, yeah, of course those folks should get, you know, some significant amount if they're unemployed. And that means that we should as well. And that's the demand, you know, like organize for that. You know, and instead it's coming out as this, that, you know, how come they're getting this and I'm not? Yeah, can we take something from this that's useful, you know, going forward?
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that perhaps we can take from it is that, you know, for a long time, we always hear these things about what can't be done. And, you know, it turns out that actually when there is a need and there is some pressure, as happened when the sort of the moment of that shutdown happened, and there was an immediate need to figure out how to get money to people, and there wasn't a way to actually figure out what people's wages were and get them proportionate unemployment in a timely way, that the decision was made to go ahead with the $600. And I think that can in fact and serve as an important reminder that, you know, there aren't these like these real barriers to doing these kinds of things. Mm. That those are that there might be political barriers to it. But when there is a political will to provide people with support and to make sure that they are getting what they need, that we can actually do that. And perhaps that's one sort of takeaway from it. You know, and I would say, you know, from the arguments about it preventing people from working, I think that it's, for people who have been laid off as their businesses start opening up, and they get recalled to work, they won't continue to be eligible for those benefits. And I wonder whether in that change in which people are experiencing their income actually declining when they return to work, that sort of sparks something else. Mm. And I think we will go through a really difficult time going towards the end of the summer and into the fall, in which we start to see a lot of these traditional markers of the economy, like our unemployment rate actually like declining, but people's standards of living, you know, are also going down. and perhaps that disjuncture and that sort of people's experience there of returning to a job that's paying them less is something that can do organizing around.
I came away from this conversation with a sharp sense of the variation in experiences among workers who I'd gotten used to being clumped together as essential. There's not only the gross difference between grocery and healthcare workers, there are also important differences in their experiences within each of these industries based on income and types of regulation. This variation and its implications for class consciousness and solidarity is, of course, common knowledge among labor organizers such as Rose Bookbinder and Eric Blanc from previous episodes of this podcast. But the survey was a necessary reminder for me of the importance of remaining alert to these differences as the economy reopens. The tension reported in the survey in the attitudes of some essential workers towards their unemployed counterparts also invites a closer look. Over the next few weeks, we turn to the revolts against police brutality all over the country. I talk with Robert Cuffey, member of the New York City DSA and organizer with the Fight for Our Lives Coalition. And we'll hear from Claire Hammonds again, along with Cedric Johnson, discussing his chapter on policing in the new book, co-edited by Hammonds, Labor in the Time of Trump. Join us in thinking aloud about how our day-to-day work during Corona can cohere into a battle plan for democratic socialism after it.